You can do nothing against the master.
But we're together now. We'll always be together. We'll love each other. Forever.
Welcome back to Chronologically. This is the podcast where we go through the full filmographies of some of cinema's greatest creators. My name is Jeff, and with me, as always, is Eric.
Hey, Jeff. How's it going?
It's going well. How you doing?
I'm doing good, man. I'm doing really well. I'm excited to have this conversation this week.
I'm glad. Anyway, that sounded like sarcasm. So this is season four, and this season we're going through the 70s and 80s films based on the works of Stephen King. This is episode two, and this time we took a look at the 1979 version of Salem's Lot. Now, I've had to do something if you saw last week's episode in the feed. I've had to put the years on the titles because we're going to see several Carries. We're going to see at least another Salem's Lot at this point. So it is important for us to mention the year that they came out.
Yeah, at least one more Salem's Lot, I guess, and you're probably aware of this. There's a third Salem's Lot, and it's just kind of floating in the movie ether right now. It was supposed to come out in 2023. It did not, and it's apparently complete, and it's just kind of hanging out, waiting for a release date. And as we all know in this day and age, that may never happen. Like,
yeah,
there are movies.
Batgirl.
Yeah, Batgirl. There are movies that just disappear. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out and whether or not that'll release. Well, I mean, we'll get into the modern day in 4 years. So hopefully between now and then, we'll have an answer.
There eventually.
Yeah.
So this is a made-for-TV miniseries that came out in 79. Now, I watched the one on Vudu, or I bought essentially this movie because it had Movies Anywhere and it meant you could watch it on my account and all that good stuff. So it was edited like a 3-hour film, but it is the full, I believe they have even in the, on Amazon, they have the little blurbs you get, like special things. Apparently there were added scenes in this version to make it a little more gory since it was essentially a film version.
Yeah, I got a breakdown. I got a breakdown of the edits here and what's going on.
Okay.
So initially this was shown over two nights back in 1980, or 1979. And, it was such a big hit. They showed it over and over again throughout the years. Like it was in heavy rotation on cable back in the day. People really love this. Then as they were filming it, they filmed gorier versions of certain sequences. There is also the moment when the guy makes real estate guy hold the shotgun up to his head. They filmed a version of that where he puts the shotgun in his mouth, you know, just like slightly more intense versions of things. And they did that with the intention of releasing it to theaters in Europe. Right. So there is about a hour and 30 minute version that was released to theaters in Europe with like a whole bunch of side story cut out of it. And it's just, you know, a much tighter experience. Some say so tightened up that it becomes kind of nonsensical. Like there's big chunks missing out of the movie that kind of take away from the experience.
That's interesting. Because I feel like even in this version, there's a lot of things you could trim. There's some fat that could be trimmed out of this, but maybe they had to trim too much.
There is some fat you could trim out, and I feel like there's some other stuff you could put in that would kind of clean it up. We'll get there. But then the version that we watched was essentially the TV version, and they took out the ending credits for the first segment and the recap in front of the second segment and just kind of spliced them together. But as you're watching, when you get to that hour 30 minute point, you can really tell where the first sequence, like where the first segment ends. Like it just comes to like a very distinct ending. I was watching it with my daughter and we hit that point and I was like, all right, that's it for tonight. And tomorrow we will see the conclusion.
So you watched it like a mini series then?
I totally did. Yeah. Partially, I would have maybe watched it straight through, but I was watching with my 11-year-old, and it was a school night, and it got to be like 10:30, and so I was like, no, we're not staying up another hour and a half.
So how do you get an 11-year-old to sit through a three-hour movie from the 70s?
She loved it. It was shocking. She loved it.
That's crazy, because I can barely get my son to sit through like a Jurassic Park movie at times. Well, like he'll be like, all right, that's enough.
I think I turned it into a reward to begin with. I was like, if you do these dishes, I'm going to let you stay up and watch The Vampires with me. And she was like, oh, The Vampires. So she did the dishes and I let her stay up. And by the time we got to the end, like the end of the first segment, you've already had homeboy like outside the window, you know, scratching on the window and all of that stuff. And that's where she really bought in, like in a giggly, this is fun and kind of creepy sort of way, you know?
That's great.
And so, yeah, she was super jazzed to watch the second half the next day, you know, like, because my wife bailed after like 30 minutes on the first half. And so she was like, and so mom, and so then the kid, he's out on the window and he's scratching on the window. And the other kid, he's so stupid, he just lets him in, you know. So it was a very entertaining way to watch this, watching her watch it as I watched it.
Yeah, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, I also
was just curious.
The other piece of the puzzle is that I just read the book. So I'll just launch into my history.
I'm ready. This is what I'm waiting for. I'm ready to hear this.
Yeah. So this is one of the only Stephen King properties that I've never engaged with. I've never seen this movie. I've never seen the sequel. I've never seen the theatrical cut. I never read the book. And it is the only, from like the first 30 years of Stephen King's writing, this is the only book that I didn't read. And I don't know why. There's no reason. Like, I just always passed it up. And so I very much had like a Back to the Future 3 situation going when I picked up this book to read it, because all of a sudden, here's a special treat. Here's this thing that I've never experienced from a creator that I love. And I got to do it for the very first time, you know? And, so that was great. But like in relation to my daughter, as I was reading it, I was telling her like story beats as they happened, you know, oh, the doctor died, he fell down the stairs, you know, and so that was the other piece that got her interested in watching, because she already knew kind of like what it was about and what was going to happen and so on.
And is she a reader as well?
She is.
Okay.
She is. In fact, she was like, maybe I'll read this book now. I was like, no. You're not going to read this book.
Let's give it a couple years.
Back to Harry Potter with you. But yeah, she's, you know, at that like Hunger Games, Harry Potter, you know, level of reading, Shadow and Bone,
right,
like that sort of like tween fantasy sci-fi
stuff.
The
YA section, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. That's where she lives. So it's just like a blink of an eye before she moves into the Stephen King era, you know. So yeah, so I really enjoyed the book, and then I was able to watch this movie like with the book very fresh in my mind. And so I'm going to do my best in this conversation not to be, you know, well, the book, blah, 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 blah.
I want you to be the book. Well, when it's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Because
yeah, when it makes sense, I totally want you to do that.
Okay, cool. So what was your history with this?
None. I have no history with Salem's Lot. In a lot of ways, I'm sort of a Stephen King novice. I've seen a handful of films, you know, Misery, you know, your Shawshanks, Apt Pupil, It Chapter. I've seen both versions of It. I've seen The Shining. You know, I've seen kind of the big hitters.
Yeah.
And Gerald's Game was a recent one that came out. But I'm just generally not like a Stephen King head. When you said, you told me that you had started reading the book, I was like, ooh, maybe I'll read the book. And I downloaded it. Or I didn't get the whole thing. I started the sample on, you know, Kindle. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to get this done in time to record. And so I didn't want to read it at that point. Now, I may get to it at some point, but I just was like, unless I can finish it in time for the review, I don't want to read it. So I put it down.
Well, it sets a dangerous precedent, because like typically as we're recording Inside Baseball, we record once a week, right? And we release the episodes every 2 weeks, and that gives us a little bit of a cushion for when we need to skip. And this time we had a 3-week break in between Carrie and Salem's Lot. So that allowed me to read that giant ass book.
Yeah.
But it did set this thing in my mind where like, well, maybe I'll read all the books. Like, no, I cannot reread every single Stephen King book, like one a week for 4 years. Like, it's just never going to happen. So,
well, and the other thing is that my thing I would point out is maybe just read the ones you hadn't, you know, like the Salem's Lot, like,
yeah,
sort of thing. Did you put Dark Tower on our list? You probably had to have. Right?
I did. Yeah, the theatrical. Yeah, I did. And that's the other big missing piece of the puzzle for me is that I've never read any of the Dark Tower books. Although in my research for Salem's Lot, I found it very interesting because some Salem's Lot characters play a major role in the Dark Tower series, which I was like kind of shocked that it all comes back around. So yeah, it was pretty interesting. Yeah, like a large piece of Dark Tower continues the Salem's Lot storyline, which is just bonkers. But sure, go ahead, Stephen King.
Yeah. So yeah, no real history here. I didn't have any expectations. I had seen like a trailer or two. I've seen this Nosferatu looking vampire before somewhere else, but that's about it. You know.
Right. Okay. So coming in cold, I'm interested in just hearing what your experience was like. Like it's a hard ask to sit down and watch a full miniseries from the 1970s in this day and age, you know, like television standards back then were different.
Yes.
Pacing was different. The way they shot was different. Like these days, when we sit down to watch what we consider like prime TV, it's almost as good as a feature film, just longer,
right?
Like the special effects are on par with what we would see in a theater or very close. And that was not the case back then, you know. Like I last night rewatched Wizard of Oz with my family, and I was watching the special effects, and I was like, God damn, for 1938, these are some bomb special effects. Like, this is really good. And then I had a brief moment of, well, that was better than some of that shit that I saw in Salem's Lot. Like,
yeah.
That was 40 years before that. So, yeah, what was your experience like?
I, generally speaking, I like older films. I like the 70s and 80s and the 90s grain. So that part's not a problem. The problem for me was more the pacing. I felt there was a lot. The other big problem, well, I thought it was the pacing. And then the other big problem, I think, is that it wasn't rated R. I really think that this would have benefited by being able to go there a little more. It feels, pun intended, like the fangs were taken out of this movie a bit because so much of the stuff that happens off screen. Like when we get Fred Willard out of nowhere and Fred Willard gets killed off screen and all you see is the vampire hand or whatever, you know, and I just kind of felt like, man, I wanted more teeth to this movie. After we watched, you know, Carrie, I'm like, come on, like, because you know Stephen King, and something you said to me when you were reading the book, you forgot how mean Stephen King can be in his older works. And I was just expecting something with a little more punch to it than this.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Okay. So as I was watching it, it occurred to me how much takes place off screen, like in the book too. It's an interesting story because a lot of the stuff that's happening in the town is like inferred, you know, and it does a lot of that, like in the movie too, you know, like this person may have been bitten and they kind of disappear and, oh, they're sick and they could be a vampire, you know, and like, there's a lot of that going on where like the prime characters just don't know. And they're kind of putting the pieces of the puzzle together. And there's like this kind of Invasion of the Body Snatchers vibe, you know, like, is he not, you know, like we're not sure. And then it becomes a case of like, let's try to convince people of what's going on. So yeah, like the stuff that I was referring to is Stephen King being mean. There's this whole subplot with this young couple who got married out of high school. There are a lot of characters in the book that are not in the film. And a lot of
good.
A lot of the
because
characters.
There are a lot in here. I didn't think, like, I even think, like, the whole Fred Willard subplot with him and his baby girl and the you know, the whole love triangle thing.
Boom,
I felt
Bonnie.
Like, why was this in the movie?
Yeah, yeah. Like, so, that's actually like 6 or 7 different characters out of the book all smashed together into those three people, you know, and yeah, it's
interesting.
It's interesting how they combined a lot of the characters into you know, a smaller group. But there was this whole subplot with this young couple, and they had a baby. And the mom is like 17 or 18, and she just keeps fucking punching the baby.
Whoa.
It's like, oh, jeez. My God. And then the baby dies, and then the baby, you know, it's inferred that the baby is a vampire, you know, and it's just like, oh, Jesus Christ.
Does that make the vampire the good guy then? You know, like if he brings dead baby back to life?
Or saves the baby in some way. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying. I don't remember the specifics of how that all played out because, again, a lot of the stuff is like vagaries, you know, like it just kind of is happening in the shadows behind the scenes. There's like a sense of paranoia to the whole thing. Yeah. So, but yeah, that was the part where I was like, oh man, this is so damn mean. But yeah, I totally get what you're saying about the pacing. My wife was laughing because there are so many shots of like, show Ben Mears, show the house, show Ben Mears, show the house. Ben Mears is looking at the house, you know, and in the book, he's like obsessed with the house. Like he's really, because he has this history of sneaking in when he was a kid and seeing the ghost. And there's a lot more, like he goes a lot more into depth of the history of the house there and so on. And so I think that's what they're trying to convey. But really, it just comes off as, wow, we just spent 3 minutes showing this dude looking at a house, you know?
Like, really. I didn't mind that because for me, the house was actually one of the pluses. It very much had a Bates House vibe to it a bit, you know? So I was kind of good with that. When they get inside, the house is just nasty.
Oh, my God. So- The design inside the house, I have it as a note for later, but we'll just get into it now. Like, okay, so the outside of the house, apparently they bought a real house and then built that exterior of the house around an existing house, right? So the house was up on the cliff and it was perfect. It's just what they needed, but it wasn't the right looking house. So they built this shitty house around that house. And then the interiors were on like a soundstage or something. But man, when they get into that house, like the detail work inside there is incredible. And we're watching it in high def now, and this was just made for like shitty 1970s like grainy TV.
Yeah,
and they still put a lot of effort into the interior of that house because that is a nasty looking house. Like,
it's gross in there.
It's like, don't sit on that cushion, don't touch that railing. Like, it is nasty in there.
I half expected it to be furnished because that old dude, Dr. what's his name, he like bought the house. I kind of felt like he lived there, and I guess maybe he does because he's
a creeper,
right? He's sort of like a Renfield character.
Yeah.
And but I thought he had like furnished it, and they kept talking about, what's the name of the vampire,
Mr. Barlow,
and I thought that Mr. Barlow wanted to have some nice digs, but did not. He was fine with a coffin in the deep basement.
Yeah, these are some gross, like, hiding out in the woodshed underneath the planks sort of vampires. Like, they are just super, I'm going to dig a hole in the ground and just sleep here sort of gross things. And most of them are kind of, like, not really thinking. They're not really cognizant. They're just, like,
they're closer to zombies.
They're zombie-like, yeah, for sure. Except for, in the book, Mr. Barlow, who actually... they changed like a lot for this movie because he is witty and charming and evil and funny and awful in the book.
That's what I kind of wanted, was a more almost like Dracula in Dracula, in the Bram Stoker Dracula with
Gary Oldman.
Something a little more sophisticated and interesting, because this vampire is very much just a creature of instinct.
Yeah, yeah. And he's much more Stryker-like. Like, there's Stryker, Mr. Stryker, who's James Mason, and then there's Barlow. And both of them are, like, really just, like, mustache-twirling villains in the book. Like, at the point where he takes Susan, he leaves them this letter, and it's, like, two solid pages of him just fucking them up. Like, like, just really, really witty writing about how sorry they are and how they're never going to catch him, you know? And, yeah, it's very cool. I guess they changed him to more of a Nosferatu type because they were specifically trying to avoid the Dracula type.
Okay.
And they just felt that it had been done a lot recently in other films, and so they were trying to kind of do something different. But I kind of felt like they lost a little bit by making him like this non-thinking creature thing, because he was so good in the book. He's like, he's so mean and funny. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. I just kind of out of curiosity looked at the 2004 Salem's Lot. It's got Rob Lowe, and it looks like casting wise, maybe they're going for a little bit more of that, you know, hopefully.
Yeah.
I kind of like to see that. So
it'll be interesting when they get there. But back to the house, I also really loved the way they filmed the house interiors. There are certain shots where, like, and it's interesting because it's in like a TV. Ratio, but there are certain shots where they pull back and you can see Bonnie Bedelia's Susan on the second floor, and you can see Mark Petrie, I think his name is, the young boy kind of like coming up the stairs, and you could like get a sense of the whole layout of what that room is like and all of its like detailed glorious moldy nastiness. I really thought it was cool. Like there were sections there where I was like, "Ooh, wow, for TV, what a nice shot." Like really, really cool looking stuff when they're inside that house.
Yeah, I that was a highlight for me. Was definitely once they got announced. And of course, that's about when the movie really starts to pick up, which again, it kind of felt like a real slow slog to get here, but
yeah,
there were some stories that I was interested in. Despite me saying I don't know why this is in the film, the whole Fred Willard story. Also, it was nice. It was fun to see Fred Willard like really young, you know,
in some super hot 70s clothes. When he comes out and he's in that white outfit with the white pants and the white shirt and the white tie, I was just like, yeah. Oh, Fred Willard, look at you! You look like you're gonna sell somebody a car. And tell him about Jesus. Like,
I'd let him sell me a car.
Yeah, I thought that whole thing was pretty good too. And but it's funny the way those three just disappear from the movie. Like,
yeah, that's kind of where I got lost. Is like all three of those characters. And did anything happen? Like the last I think we see of the husband and wife is he goes into the room and you hear him hit her and then. Nothing.
I think there's one more scene where she's got a bruise and they're riding in the car talking about something. She's got like a black eye or something.
But they survived and just drove off, and then Fred Willard gets killed by Mr. Barlow.
Yeah, and presumably becomes a vampire. Yeah, and again, like a lot of that happens in the book, like characters just kind of drop out and presumably become vampire. And I feel like that's where this movie kind of gets into shaky ground. Because it doesn't quite nail the scale of what's going on. Like, by the end of the book, every human being in Salem's Lot, besides Ben Mears and the kid, is either dead or a vampire.
Right.
Everyone. Like, they get everyone. And those two barely escape by the skin of their teeth. And that isn't quite conveyed like in this movie that the entire town is just gone, you know, like the streets are empty. Like they find that cop who runs away. He runs away in the book too, but it's a much different vibe. Like they find him just sitting on the stairs to the police station and he's just like, vampires, dog, I'm out of here. Like just super super matter of fact, like I'm not doing this. And so that's the piece. And again, I hope the 2004 does that a little better, because it is like a full scale invasion deal, you know? So yeah, I don't know. Interesting differences. What did you think? Okay, guy who plays Ben Mears, I think he was either Starsky or Hutch from Starsky and Hutch.
Okay.
What did you think of him as a protagonist? Like the performance and the character.
He's played by David Soul, and I think he does a good job, but not a. And again, I think it's the character. I don't think the character is likable enough because he kind of is. The way he approaches the love interest in the forest feels kind of weird and a little kind of sleazy. Like she's reading my book. This will be an easy mark. And there was something a little sleazy about him that kept me from thinking he's the good guy.
Yeah, I get that. And I mean, that could just be like 1970s sleaze vibe, you know, like things in general were sleazier back then.
Yes. His hair, you know, is, you know, that sort of thing. And then, I don't know. I just felt like his relationship with the lead was kind of a power dynamic that, you know, she's like a student learning, reading his books. And here he comes in, you know, the writer of those books and just sort of sweeps her off her feet, for lack of a better term. And, you know, I just kind of felt like, and she's in an abusive relationship that she needs to get out of because apparently that's toxic. So that's all fine. And honestly, none of it is super bad, but it just kind of felt creepy.
I agree with you. I agree with you that he feels a little creepy and kind of a little boring. Like,
yes.
Like, I don't get why, outside of the fact that he wrote these books, she would be charmed by him in any way. Like, I didn't find him charming or interesting at all. And I thought that she was very charming and very interesting. Like,
yes.
So she's Bonnie Bedelia. And before this, if you ask me about Bonnie, all I would say was Die Hard. Die Hard. I know her from Die Hard because she's John McClane's wife from Die Hard. But in this movie, I was like, oh, I'm starting to get her like a little more as a performer. Like, I thought that she was very interesting with the way she delivered her lines in this kind of offhand, naturalistic way. You know, she almost felt like she was in a different movie from everybody else, and it felt like everybody else was acting in a TV film and she was acting in a film, you know.
Yeah.
like she just was very natural and I don't know, pretty and charming, and like I really, really liked her. And so that led me to the same disconnect that you had, just because I was like, why would she like this dude, you know? Like, he's just this weirdo who came rolling into town, and you know, like, yes, he might seem kind of like worldly and accomplished compared to the people who live in the town, but I mean, he doesn't seem like any prize, you know. It's not like he's like a best-selling author or anything. He's just this dude who's written a couple books. So yeah, I didn't really understand that relationship either. And of course, it's a, you know, it's an older film, and so people just randomly fall in love, and it's so quick, and you don't really understand or get to see that process very well. But the whole relationship just kind of felt a little to me.
Yeah, I agree. And there's an age difference. I was, interestingly enough, I reviewed a movie over on the Movie Draft House called Seeking a Friend for the End of the World.
Oh, I love that.
And there's but there's like an age difference between Keira Knightley and
Steve Carell.
Thank you.
Yeah.
In that movie, that just kind of made me feel a little like, you know, but my counterpart, Mark, did not see that, but I felt that way in this movie as well.
Interesting. I can't remember in that movie. Do they like get together or do they just hang out?
Yeah.
Do they
get together at the end? Well, they hook up in a car about midway through the movie, and then at the end they're together.
Right.
It's a good movie. I just, that took me a minute to get through.
Felt a little hinky.
Just a bit.
Right on. How about, okay, another character that I felt was pretty underserved in this was Mark Petrie, the boy who likes monsters. What was your take of him coming into this cold and not knowing anything about that character ahead of time? What did you think about that kid?
I actually, like, I thought he was okay, and I really liked, there are things, I think he was one of the better characters, to be honest, because I liked the fact that here's this kid, he has these in monster movies and things like that. And his parents are like, when are you going to get over this? Right. And it's, I think a lot of people can relate to maybe being into comic books or something like that and having a parent be like, when are you growing out of this? You know, and, you know, him not him being like, I don't want to grow up. This is what I like. So I found that appealing. I really like when his parents get killed and he's like, I'm going to fucking kill you. Like, he points at that ugly, dangerous vampire. He's like, I'm going to get you. Right. And I loved that he wasn't scared at that moment. You killed my parents. I'm going to kill you. And so I thought the character made sense. He was more interesting than our protagonist. I liked him, to be honest.
Cool. I'm glad. I'm glad because he is one of the best characters in the book. And in the book, he's maybe a little younger. He's like 11 or 12, but he's like this like super self-possessed kid, like just like calm, confident. Like when you're introduced to him in the book, he's new in town and the town bully tries to take him out and he turns the tables and like beats the shit out of the bully just calmly and then just walks away, you know?
Nice.
And, yeah. And like before long, like there's this kind of team assembles and it's Ben Mears, the English teacher guy, who ends up in the hospital and then disappears from the movie. The priest, who is hardly in the movie at all. And the doctor, who in the book is not Susie's dad. He's like just a doctor. Okay. And Mark. And they fully accept this kid as part of the team. Like 100%, like he's given all the rights and responsibilities as part of Kill Vampire Team number one, you know?
Right.
And I think part of it is because he just takes it upon himself to go there and kill people. And in the book, he kills Stryker. He just kills that dude. and then the other guys are like, good job, chum, join the team. He's a really interesting character. I also love the part, and it's in both the book and the film, where floaty vampire shows up outside the window, scratching like, let me in. He's like, nope, yeah. go away. And then he just goes back to bed. just lays back down and goes to sleep. Like, well, that's done.
Well, I think in this movie, he did a better job of like holding onto that cross and being like, okay, some shit's going down here. It wasn't quite as like, all right, back to bed. But especially when you, like you said, your daughter watches, why is that kid opening the window? He's so stupid. Like, this creepy kid is outside. Also, great visual. Like, one of the best visuals in the movie is the kid floating out the window, tapping on the glass.
Oh, so good. So, so good. Like, I don't know if you noticed, but I noticed it particularly when the older brother shows up outside Mark's window. It seems like they filmed it in reverse and then like flipped it. Like the smoke is coming back towards him as opposed to like coming off of him.
Oh, neat.
Like he's like sucking in the fog into his body from, you know, and it's a really cool effect. And yeah, like I was kind of impressed with the way after they open the window, the kid comes through the window and sets down on the floor. That made me really be like, oh, how did they do that? Like, that's not wires because they couldn't get him through the window. And he actually comes all the way through and sits down. Oh, my daughter quickly pointed out that every time there's somebody floating outside the window, it's the same window. Like, they, like no matter whose house they're in, they had one window that they had set up with that little latch and it swings open. And so every time it happened, she was like, same window. Same window. Like, yeah.
That's awesome.
You're right. It's the same window.
So that's part of how they did it. They had one rigging to do it properly, and that was it.
Yeah, yeah. They built it one time and used it over and over again.
They have the same window at the hospital they do at his house.
Exactly. How did you like James Mason? Like, are you familiar with James Mason outside of the context of this movie? He's Stryker.
Oh, I loved him. He was awesome. Like, he's what I wanted from, you know, Mr. Barlow. Like, he had that menacing charm. Like, he was able to be menacing and charming in the same breath, right? So I think he was great. I like being British always helps, you know, but I think he was fantastic because he is the villain for most of the movie. And so I think he carried his part of the film very well.
Yeah, I think he's great, too. We initially ran into him. I think we watched Lolita, the Kubrick Lolita, and he's the creepy old guy pursuing the young woman in that. And he's amazing.
Child in that.
Yeah, a child, exactly, yeah. he's amazing in that film. And then not long after that, we watched the Judy Garland version of A Star is Born, and he's the dude in that. And he is amazing in that movie. It's the same deal. Like, he's so charming, and he's all drunk and stuff, you know, and falling apart, but he's, like, super funny and witty. And that's when I really locked in on James Mason. I was like, I'm going to watch anything this guy does. Like, and whenever I come across a movie and he shows up in the credits, I'm like, yay! So I didn't realize he was in this. And so when he showed up, I was just delighted. I was so happy that he was in this because he is just really charming, really witty, sometimes like menacing like that. And
he was in North by Northwest.
You got to go back and take another look at it, man.
I got to rewatch it. Who was he in North by Northwest?
Got that IMDb up there, huh?
Yeah, I got to do it again. I love North by Northwest. It's an easy rewatch.
Cool.
Sorry, I derailed you.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I just like sing the praises of James Mason.
So there's one guy. Jeffrey Lewis, who played Mike Ryerson.
Is that the graveyard keeper guy?
Yeah, I think he's related to Ned Ryerson. He don't know Ned the Head.
Right.
But no, so I recognize him. Like, I know this dude. I've seen him in something, and not just I've seen him in a bunch of things, but I know him from something specific. Turns out he played the father figure to Jean-Claude Van Damme in the film Double Impact. God, it all comes back to Van Damme.
That's awesome.
That's all I wanted to bring up.
I like him, though.
He's really good.
That he is maybe the most effective vampire in the film. Like when he shows up in the teacher's house, after he dies and they pull him out, and then he just shows up in there again, in that chair. I'm like, oh, he is creepy. He is a creepy blue man. Like,
that is maybe the second best visual in the film.
Yeah.
Right. Is that him in the rocking chair? Really good.
Yeah. Very, very creepy. Creepier than Barlow for sure. Like, just really.
So that's what killed me, was like Barlow, and maybe it's because it was too bright. And I've always found Nosferatu to be very unsettling. Like, if you've seen the pictures of him from the silent film, I was always scared of that. But in this, he's just blue and the makeup's caked on, and it just doesn't work for me as him being scary.
It ain't great. The eyes are very interesting. The eyes throughout all the vampires are very interesting and cool, like those glowing contacts they have them in. And then Barlow's are like really intense. There's like bloodshot running through them, and they're all crazy looking. And so that part is neat. But yeah, I did think that maybe a bit overdone on him. Like you said, all the pancake work that they've got going on there
might have been
a little too far, you know.
For me, it was.
Yeah. So Ned Tibbetts, who is Bonnie Bedelia's plumber boyfriend.
I thought he was excellent in this movie.
I just wanted to briefly talk about the scene where Ben Mears comes into his room. And that guy jumps out of something. What the hell was he in?
Love that. How long was he there?
How did he get inside it?
It wasn't even a box. It was what looked like, you know, in like older movies and stuff, when women would change their clothes, they'd go behind the like fold out.
Okay. You
know, almost like thing, like, right?
He was kind of
behind
that.
And then when Ben Mears opens the door, the way it's positioned is the little blocker thing covers our view as the camera, And then the door itself, when it's open, covers Ben Mears' view. And so he just pops up like he's out of a birthday cake and beats the shit out of Ben Mears. It was so funny.
Yeah, when it happened, I should have rewound it so I could get a better view. Like, I just laughed out loud when it happened. I was like, what the hell?
There are a couple moves like that that are funny to me. Like, when near the final sequence, when Mr. Barlow sits up and he just kind of pushes him down a little bit. And it's just like, so not violent of a push against this crazy vampire. I just found that funny. Yeah. But yeah, that moment for me, I did have to rewind and be like, wait a minute, was he in a cardboard box? What happened? Right. Just awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty good. And then he beats the hell out of Ben Mears, and Ben Mears has like one little bruise on his forehead. You know, like he kind of holds his head a couple times like, oh, the pain from the concussion, from the terrible beating I took that left zero marks on
me. He should have looked way worse.
Yeah, he totally should have looked. If he was hospitalized by that beating, he should have been.
My brother once beat up one of my friends to a point. He didn't go to the hospital, but his head looked like hamburger. So I felt they could have done more there.
I often think about like the 70s and 80s when I grew up and some of the beatings we delivered to each other, which would have in these days ended in arrest. Like we would have absolutely gotten arrested for beating the shit out of each other as badly as we did back then. Like just heinous, unbelievable beatings. Then we'd send kids home with like their lips all busted up and their eyebrows all broken open and, you know, just blood everywhere, and then just go about our day, you know.
Like, yeah,
or we would go home looking like that, you know. And it's funny.
That's pretty rough. Like, I think I've gotten in a handful of fights in my childhood, excluding the ones with my brother, because those are too numerous to count. But yeah, I'm glad I don't get bloodied very often anymore.
Oh yeah, well, never any. Well, knock on wood, knock on fake wood.
I mean,
desk.
I've not gotten beaten up, but you know, cut something on a cutting broccoli, I chopped the tip of my thumb off or whatever.
Yeah, it's just neighborhood stuff, you know. Like I remember one time these two guys down the street. Our front yards were like straight and then a hill down and then sidewalk and then another piece of grass. They picked me up at the top of the hill, one by my hands and one by my feet, and just swung me and threw me off the hill so I landed on the sidewalk.
Jeez.
And I went home and I told my dad and he was like, stop being a tattletale. Yep. Okay. Neighborhood shit. That's just how it went down back then. I don't know. Off topic. So where were you on the ending of this? How did you feel about it?
To not answer your question, I'll say in general, the further away I got from this movie, the less I liked it.
Okay.
And the ending was fine, I guess. Like, they end up killing the guy in the coffin, and I kind of went into this expecting a lot more thrills and chills, and they just pull the guy out, hit him with the stake through the heart. I kind of liked, there's another part of this where when he's trying to drive the stake in and the kid is up next to him and he just shoves the shit out of the kid, Ben Mears does.
Oh, he does.
And he hits the ground hard.
I was like, the Kevin Costner Waterworld School of Throwing Children.
That was pretty good. But, you know, I kind of liked the hammer, and that was appropriately intense, and him locking the little gate where the other vampires are coming through, and then they set it on fire and drive away. And then they cut back to another place where the vampires have found them, I guess.
Yeah.
I didn't like it. I mean, I really was expecting more from this, to be honest, and it just didn't quite deliver. The ending was kind of ho-hum to me.
It felt to me like they were almost setting up a television series, you know, like, and now it's going to be the adventures of Ben and Mark as they cross the land like Lou Ferrigno in The Incredible Hulk and get into adventures fighting the vampires who are hunting them down. Like, that's the vibe that I got from it. In the book, they... They kill Susan first, like immediately. As soon as they discover she's a vampire, they go in there and pull her out.
Oh, right. I didn't even talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they kill Barlow, and then they run away because they're the last two alive. And, but nobody comes after them. And then they have, like, you know, a couple of years where they're just freaking out. And then they decide they're going to go back and burn down the town, and they do, and that's the end. With the intention that then they're going to, like, go through and kill anybody that survives the burning of the entire town. In this, it felt very, it felt a little disjointed, and it felt, again, like that it was set up for something more to come that never came, you know?
Yeah. I will say, I did like that they held off on the love interest coming back, Susan, and doing that as a separate point. You know, they locate her later. And then you see she's a vampire, because we never really see what happens to her. She just kind of gets abducted and disappears. Yeah. I kind of like that. I thought that was effective for him to have to come back and take her out, you know. That's about it. Like, it's fine.
Okay. So I did think that the way some of the stuff, I felt like this film originated some vampire stuff that I've seen in other movies, right? Like the
that
cross,
it created it.
Yeah. I think so. Like the cross on the forehead, leaving a mark, is like super Fright Night. I don't know if you've ever seen Fright Night.
Nope. Neither of them.
Like that is like 100% some Fright Night action there. It's driving that cross into the vampire's forehead and it leaving that scar on there. The kid floating outside the window was very Lost Boys. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
Oh my God. I'm way behind on these movies.
The Lost Boys, forget Fright Night. Fright Night's great. It's a fun movie. You've seen The Princess Bride, right?
Of course.
Okay, so the king, the prince, the evil prince from The Princess Humperdinck, he's the head vampire in Fright Night. And so he's got that same like smarmy charm to him, you know, where he's like saying these offhand funny things as he's being all evil and murderous.
Right.
So it's well worth a look. It's a good movie. Especially for like you love 80s stuff. It's worth a look.
And I need to watch them. There's no excuse. Yeah.
Lost Boys is just like a stone cold classic, man. Like that is, it is a must see 80s film. But yeah, so the other piece that's in Lost Boys is somebody getting killed on those antlers, which, you know, felt lifted right out of this movie. I was like, oh, Lost Boys again. We're doing Lost Boys a lot. Or rather, Lost Boys is doing Salem's Lot a lot.
Yeah.
And that
was the first point where you see Stryker has like supernatural power. Like he's not just a guy who works for a vampire. That's when he really got that Renfield vibe where maybe he's getting something from Mr. Barlow to keep him eternal.
Yeah, and it was very unclear what that was. Like my daughter kept looking at me like waiting for me to explain it. And I was like, I don't know. Like he's a ghoul? Like they talked about ghouls? Maybe he's a ghoul? Like, I don't know. I don't know how he's lifting somebody up and carrying him down the stairs and taking 7 shots and still moving. Like I have no idea. And the movie doesn't really explain it other than,
which I was fine with.
Yeah.
I like that mystery a little bit.
Yeah, he's stronger than the average human, obviously, but he can be taken down. And
Did you watch the Nicolas Cage movie Renfield?
The first 20 minutes of it.
You didn't finish it.
No, I got to go.
Did you not like it?
I think we were kind of like about it. Yeah,
it's so much fun.
Okay. We were tired. We have a baby.
There's lots of shit
we turn off. Yeah.
Yeah, I get
you. We get tired.
Well, yeah, I recommend it if you get around to it.
Okay, I'll swing back around to it. I guess that's kind of all I had outside of just the paranoia aspect of the whole thing. Have you ever been in a situation where like you try to convince everybody that something's going on and nobody believes you? I mean, it's like a standard bad dream scenario, right?
Yeah. The closest I can think of is working in a corporation and noticing signs as to where things are going and being paranoid, say, go into my boss and be like, is this happening? Is this what I'm seeing? Oh, no. I'm like, okay. And then it happens and you're like, I should trust my gut. You know, like I've seen these things line up this way before. And so, yeah, that's the closest I could relate. Nothing like crazy though.
Yeah. I've been in that situation a lot at work too, actually, where like I realize that this thing that we're building is going to break the rules, you know, like not in the current job that I'm at, but at previous jobs, you know, I work primarily in medical software. So there's like very specific things you can and cannot do regarding mm-hmm. people's private information and their medical information. And so we'll just be going along doing the thing and, you know, I'll be in the shower one day and it'll hit me like, oh, God damn it. We're about to break like 15 laws and nobody realized it, you know?
Yeah.
And so then like having to go into work and be like, well, guys, this thing that we're doing, you know, like, and you do get some resistance when that happens, right? Because you're trying to turn the Titanic to keep it from hitting the iceberg.
Right.
That Titanic sure wants to hit that iceberg, you know, and trying to rally people to a cause like that is a struggle. But obviously I've never been in a situation where a town is being taken over by vampires and I have to convince everybody, you know?
Yeah. That's a different situation.
Yeah.
I did like that the doctor did take a while, right? Like he was like, no, no, no. And then like the vampires, he's like, all right, yep, this is vampires. And I always appreciate when vampire movies follow vampire rules, you know, sunlight, crosses, garlic. Just, I don't like it when they stray from that too much. It kind of feels cheap to
yeah,
me.
I was surprised reading the book how traditional the vampires are in the book. Like,
yeah.
Like it's Stephen King, so I expected that it was going to be like a twist on vampires or a take on vampires or, you know, something of that nature. But no, it's just straight up classical vampires, you know, like with the cross and the garlic and all that shit. Like,
yeah.
there's no, you know, modernization or scientific explanation. Or it's just vampires rolled into town. Now it's going to be apocalyptic nightmare, you know?
Yeah.
Which I appreciate it. Like I was surprised at how much it stayed in line with your standard vampire thing. And with the, of course, the Stephen King meanness and of course the trademark Stephen King ambiguous / not happy ending, you know, like as you'll, I'll probably point this out a lot as we go through these,
yeah.
But you know, when you go into one of King's books, the last thing you want to expect is a happy ending because like so many of his books are like, and everybody died, the end, or, and this one guy right. got away, but he was messed up for the rest of the life, the end, or, oh, the kid died. Sorry. The end, you know?
So unlike that Shawshank is maybe an exception then, or is the book different that they not get out of jail?
No. Shawshank is an exception. Like there are occasional yeah. happy endings, but more often than not, they're either unhappy or ambiguous or just flat out horrifying.
Yeah.
One of his more recent books, Revival, just kicked my ass. Like the ending is so raw. I was like, oh my God. Like that on that level of things, he hasn't lost his old school touch, you know, like
right.
he's still willing to kick your teeth down your throat. And it's kind of what I appreciate about him as a writer is that he doesn't pull punches, you know, like the character punches babies. Like, that's what we're doing, you know? And, yeah, it's good stuff. So, what do we got? What do we got coming up next? Unless you had more to talk about on Salem's Lot.
No, I really don't. So, next is, so what's interesting is that this is the second book that he wrote. Next is actually his fourth book, and let me know if you've heard of this film, The Shining.
Oh, The Shining. Yeah, I've heard of this film. Yeah, I think
so. We're gonna watch
Ready Player One. Was about The Shining, right? They're connected.
There was that. God. So we'll get into that next week because I'm tempted to talk about my history with The Shining, but we're gonna watch the Kubrick classic, The Shining, a movie that Stephen King notably not a big fan of, and
yeah.
most everyone else that's seen it loves it. So,
yeah, it will be an interesting conversation.
I have not watched it since I initially saw it, So
I don't want to tip my hand on it either. But yeah, don't,
I know where you stand.
Looking forward to the conversation. I don't know if you do know where I stand. I don't know if you do.
Have a picture that your wife bought you of you both photoshopped into the classic photo at the end of the film.
That's true.
My guess is I do have that. That you enjoy the film would be my guess.
Yeah, all right. All right. But do I enjoy it as much as everybody else in the universe? We'll see.
We'll get into that. Maybe I'll love it. Who knows? But that's it for us this week. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter. You can find Eric on Twitter at Eric_Hotter. You can also check out his YouTube page, Eric Hotter, as well as Gaming Nexus for all your gaming review needs. He does a lot of writing over there. If you want to get in touch with me, you can find me on Twitter at Podcast by Jeff. You can also check out my other podcast called The Movie Draft House. A little more grab bag movies over there if you want something a little more random and not so rigid, following the rules of chronologically. So I guess that's it. We'll see you in 2 weeks for The Shining.
Thanks, y'all. Bye.